Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. Happy Friday. Welcome back to Renee's Heart to Heart. This is Renee, and I am really glad you came by today. Fridays are kind of a cool day because it's the day that we kind of go over everything that we talked about all week. And this week was a really, really versatile week. We talked about everything from domestic violence to the bully project to health and brain function and what to feed your brain to enhance its capabilities. We talked a terrible story yesterday about bath salts. And today on Facebook, there's kind of shocking video that somebody took of that attack that hurt several people because of this man that was high on bath salts and took his life. Somebody videotaped it with their cell phone. And it was, the video was kind of hard to watch, to be honest with you. So if you want to get on my Facebook page, you're welcome to look at it. But it's kind of disturbing. And so is the story that goes with it. But we'll start at the beginning. And I also want to put some feelers out there. I got a call yesterday telling me that there was a news report on one of the Broward County local channels about an investigation that was done in some local halfway houses or transitional homes for teens. And everyone, according to my report, everyone that they went into, they found alcohol and drugs in, and no supervision, and no sense of decorum. So I tried to find the story. I Googled and Binged and Chromed everything I could think of to say to get a story and couldn't find anything. So if anybody has any news about that, I'm very, very interested in hearing how that went down and how many homes were actually investigated. And, of course, I've worried about this for a long time because I've been to some of these homes with teenagers and walked in and not found any. I've gone from one extreme to the other. One home that I went to was run like a reform school, almost jail-like atmosphere. And one was just an open house out here in the country, and there was no supervision. The supervisor, I think, was probably 18 and was caught up in the drama of the house, not really taking an authority place in the home. So I'm interested to hear about that. If anybody heard about that and would like to tell me where I could maybe find more information or would just like to report it to me, I would appreciate it. I'm going to bring Shell in so that we can recap this week. Good morning, Shelley.
Hello. Sorry, I had you on mute. Good morning, Renee.
I would wait a few minutes. I feel that very disturbing silence after I say good morning, Shelley, and I think to myself, she just muted the phone. So I'm looking forward to kind of rehashing this week because as I look over my notes, this was really quite a variable week. We went from domestic violence all the way down to bath salts and some good stuff in there and some not so good stuff. So
because of the one of the comments you just made, I want to respond to that. But you had said that you know a lot of the halfway houses are really not a good situation. They're not really halfway houses. They're basically flop houses. And when I had taken that course on addictionology, that was one of the things that they talked about. Especially in South Florida, we're not the only place in the United States, but it's really worse here. But a lot of the halfway houses in Florida actually are flop houses. And what they mean by a flop house is a place that's not regulated or run properly. It's basically started by other addicts. And some cases, they don't even mean well at the beginning. They're starting it just to generate money in a semi-legal way, but then they abuse the system and they actually deal drugs out of the flop house itself. So it becomes just a perpetuation of the problem anyway. So that's where the IOPs came from, which is intensive outpatient care. That's where a lot of these IOPs came from that are still not regulated properly, but at least they come with more restrictions, and the idea behind them is that they're connected to healthcare professionals, so you have people that aren't addicts that are intermixed with the running of it.
Yeah, well, that's what I was told yesterday when somebody called me and asked me if I'd seen it, and I said no. That's pretty much everything that they said as well that they witnessed on this documentary that one of the news channels did. He didn't remember the news channel or anything, so I did try to find something last night, and I found nothing. Every time I Googled anything about a halfway house or a transitional home or teen halfway houses or anything like that, I just got advertisements. So I may call a Sun Sentinel reporter friend of mine and ask him if he can direct me to where I can find the story, because I am interested in that. And yes, I am aware of it. Like I said, I've been to two. One was run like a reform school / jail, and the other was like a joke. As a matter of fact, she wasn't little, but she was 17. The girl that I took there, every time she turned around, if she took anything home or if I got her anything or if anybody else in the family got her anything to take to the house, other kids would steal it, and she had no recourse, so it wasn't very nice. So I was aware of the fact that that kind of stuff was going on, but apparently it has sprung up all over, and for the reasons that you just mentioned, because they can get government money if they say that's what they're doing, and if they have the patience to search that out, they can actually realize some income and pay for a house, and everybody has a place to live. Part of me is like, you know, if I weigh that and think to myself, at least those kids aren't on the street, that makes me feel good. But I also don't like the safe haven to be able to do anything that floats your boat. So I have very mixed emotions about it. But hopefully we'll get some more information about that, and we can talk about that next week. So Monday we talked about domestic violence, and we talked about the video that will be out on HBO this spring called Private Violence. And I got a lot of feedback, like I usually do when I talk about domestic violence, because as the title to this documentary states, it's very private, and a lot of people don't share it. And ironically, and I'm going to make this statement, and I hope this doesn't offend anybody, but usually the people that scream the loudest and get the most attention when this is going on to them are often partly to blame and get immersed in that drama. The ones that are taking it and thinking that they have to and don't fight back and don't fan the flames of it, are embarrassed by it, hurt by it, and don't want to tell anybody that it's happening to them. So we have two, you know, and maybe even more, different scenarios on how things like that get reported.
I actually agree with that. And because I've seen this is something that I've talked about a couple of times. It's kind of on the same page. But because of these court shows I watch, there are a lot of women that go on the show that complain of abuse to try and get the judge's sympathy. And if you're there and you're a loudmouth and you're just insulting the heck out of that guy and saying what a bad person he is, and you're all loudmouthed and you're screaming at the judge and, oh, I live in fear of my life every day, well, that's a frickin' act, and the judges see right through it. And it actually angers the judge when women come to court like that, getting restraining orders against these guys, because once they read the police reports, the women were just as aggressive as the men, and maybe the man did smack him, but that's because the woman jumped on his back and started scratching him or something, you know? And then when you read the whole story, you find out that it was like mutual combat. That's not abuse. That's just two people acting badly, and one of them happens to be a man. You know, a man should never hit a woman. But there are women that are very aggressive on their own, and I'm sorry. I don't care how small you are. If you're grabbing something and hitting a man, or you're tackling him to the ground or something, he should try to control himself. But if you get hit because in the midst of him defending himself, that's not abuse, and that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about women that genuinely live in fear, that it's not drama to them. It almost becomes a way of life because they become so emotionally submissive, and they don't think that they can take themselves out of the situation without increasing the harm to them, because they've gotten involved with somebody who is emotionally disturbed and controlling, and they actually fear for their lives. They've gotten them into a situation they see no light at the end of the tunnel, because if they try to leave this individual, they've actually been threatened for their life. So it's not the same, and women that try to abuse the system will say that there are petty fights that they have with their boyfriend or their husband that escalate to violence is really just mutual combat and bad behavior, and they try to equate it to this abuse to get sympathy from the court system, and it really is an abuse of the judicial system.
Well, and like I said, too many times, it is about that, and I mentioned this the other day. Some of us will take attention in any form. Bad attention, good attention ceases to have any difference when you are starved for attention. And you never know.
And they'll actually create the scenarios to bring that about.
It's what?
And men and women, it's not only women, men and women who have that need for attention will actually create those scenarios to bring it about, like you said, good or bad.
Absolutely, and that's the whole point. You know, if I don't care whether you're hugging me or smacking me, I have your undivided attention. And I even know children that have that tendency to get that attention away from other siblings, to get that attention that is directed just at them. So, but I think one of the real reason we did that story, and I don't know if we'll ever be able to on a level ground separate those two things. They'll probably always stay immersed within each other because analyzing that is probably not something that's easy to do. I know it wouldn't be for me. But there are the ladies, like you just said, who live in total fear and a place of thinking that, okay, this is the bed I made, now I got to lie in it, and they're afraid to do anything about it. Those are the ones that, of course, we have great compassion for, because that's not the way they have to live. And many times they're too afraid to tell anybody because of the repercussions.
Well, those are the ones that are suffering from the private violence, because the other one, where I'm using the word mutual combat, the other parties that may get smacked once in a while, but it's because there's mutual violence from both the man to the woman and the woman to the man, all right, that's not private violence, because these people just act badly, and it's usually wrapped around maybe getting high or being drunk or something like that, where both sides of the issue are just acting poorly. But the private violence is these situations where, and it's in most of the cases it's women, but there are men that suffer in silence as well. But when you have these people that are so either ashamed or fearful of their domestic life that they don't seek help because they don't feel that they can, either because they're afraid of the physical repercussions, that they're just going to make things worse, or because they're so ashamed. Sometimes it's business people. You know, this woman is going to work every day in a business suit, and you don't see under her suit that she's covered with bruises, you know, and the same thing with men. And like I said, even though men is a rarity, I've also seen true life stories about men that are married to these little teeny women, and they grab things and they beat the guy, and because he's a gentle giant, he won't touch her back. But he lives with this in private, and it's so embarrassing and so humiliating, they won't talk to anybody. And it really tears the individual down, whether it's a man or a woman. It tears them down over time.
Well, and I have seen that particular scenario that you just described many, many times. I've also seen the scenario where both partners, especially under the influence of something, are incredibly aggressive. And it's kind of like about how you learn to express yourself when you're very young, too. You know, a lot of this kind of adult behavior goes back to when we're kids and what we end up doing to express ourselves. So I loved it when shows, cartoon shows, kids shows, started talking about how you touch other people and how you put your hands on other people. Because some of us, it comes from a good place. You know, I think I've told this story before, maybe not, but I reached out and a young man was messing with me at a cash register at, I don't know, 1 o'clock in the morning. I was the manager of a Denny's. And he said, I'm not going to pay this bill. And he was a little, I don't know what he was under the influence of. He wasn't straight. He says, I'm not going to pay this. He's got his money in his hand and puts his hands on the countertop. And I put my hands on his hands, and I said, don't be a brat. Pay your bill. You know, I'm busy. I don't want to do this right now. He screamed and started going off on me because I had put my hands on him.
Wow.
And totally, totally by surprise, I got to tell you. I mean, I was like, huh? You know? And luckily, I had two Deerfield police sitting in the back room, and when they heard me yell, they came running out, and then, of course, the young man handed me the money. The minute he just saw them walking towards the register, he handed me the money and left. But it taught me a very, very valuable lesson. Because I have often, I'm a toucher sometimes, and I reach
yep.
out and touch somebody's hand or somebody's shoulder or be in close confines and put my hands on somebody else. And some people really take major offense to that. So it was
really
valuable for me, you know. But again, that's something that I think happens when you're very young. If somebody touches you continuously when you're a small child and the touch is aggressive and usually leads to something that's unpleasant, then you probably don't like, especially a stranger, putting their hands
right.
on you.
And then any touch becomes invasive and
yes.
Inappropriate to them, regardless of you're just touching the back of their hand or whatever. Yeah, I've seen people that are oversensitized to that, and they can't handle any touch, like you said, especially from a stranger. So it really is important, because I'm a toucher too, you know, and it's I also had similar incidences like that where it was harmless and the person just completely overreacted. But like you said, it seems like an overreaction to you and I, but it's not an overreaction to that individual because of what it represents to them or the memories that it brings up. And that's why you really never know what you're dealing with a perfect stranger. So you always have to err on the side of caution, and whether you think it's overkill or not, you have to be overly appropriate when you're dealing with somebody that you don't know.
That's right, and that's the whole point. It's about overstepping your grounds with a stranger in a lot of cases. And, of course, I'm very maternal. I'm old. I don't think anybody's going to be offended by my touch. That's my own personal feeling on that. So I never gave it any thought until this happened. And this was, gosh, this was 20 years ago. But I still felt, I mean, you know, my oldest kid is 45, so I've been a mom a long time. And I didn't even think that he would be offended by it, but he was. And it wasn't an act. He was really upset that I put my hands on his hands. So it was a lesson. It was a good lesson for me and something I've never forgotten. But it does have to do with that whole arena of violence and hurting somebody with your hands. Now, Tuesday, we talked about, we did our workbook, From Bullies to Buddies. And we did a lot of conversing about how we handle things and how we want our kids to grow up. And, of course, the bully show is always leads us to talk about many different things. We did talk about this week about the fact that how we grow up thinking what we're supposed to expect of others. A good part of Izzy's book talks about the expectations, like saying to your kid, you know, nobody's ever supposed to hurt you. You have the right to not ever be hurt by anybody. Well, that's all very nice, but it's not very honest. And Izzy talks about that, and he says it's, you almost always have to prepare your children, whether you're their parent or their teacher or whoever you are in their life, that expectations of kindness and love and everybody from every corner of your world is not very realistic. And of course, a lot of times it's done out of a person that's had just plain and simple having a bad day, or maybe something you've done that you don't even know you've done. But the point is you have to be prepared that you're not going to please everybody all of the time. And everybody isn't going to fall in love with you. And everybody isn't going to hold your safety, your happiness in their hands. That stuff is in your hands and always will be. So he teaches us to teach our kids to expect things and learn how to deal with it. Learn how to accept it and deal with it, filter it, and take care of it themselves instead of going to, you know, tattle on everybody and make their own little small world even worse. On the only soap opera I've continued watching all my life, there's one of the main characters has been called in because her adorable little daughter, she thinks somebody's bullying her in the Catholic school. And she goes to school, and this father confronts her and says his son doesn't even want to come to this school anymore because of her daughter. So it gets flipped around in her face. She's coming in because she thinks her kid's being bullied, and she finds out that her kid is the bully. And right. I quite liked the seeing this on the show because it was quite a twist. And when they both talk, as usual, when the kids are sitting there and mom and dad, you know, the father of the boy and the mother of the girl, are being aggressive with each other because they're sticking up for their kid, which is usually the normal scenario, then the two kids look at each other, and the little girl said, you know, I didn't tell anybody you tore the badge off my uniform. I didn't tell anybody that. My mom saw it. And she came to school, and that's why this is happening. I didn't tattle on you. And he said, you didn't? And she said, no. And the father says, well, yeah, but they all pick on him all the time, all these girls. And the boy said, well, he said, you know, he said, they kind of like, there's like three of them, and there's one of me, and they go on and on, and the two kids talk it out. Mom and the two so pissed at each other, by the way, because their adult indignance is rising up because they're talking about their kid. But the way it played out, I thought, now that's really a true-to-life thing. The two parents are still mad at each other. The two kids walk off into the sunset because once somebody's opened a forum for them to look at each other and talk, not in front of all the other kids where they have to save face all the time, they became friends.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that what the concept that you were talking about, the fact, you know, that Izzy explains that, you know, kids today are not given realistic expectations that everybody's going to be kind to them, and it's that they're right to have people treat them kindly. Well, that also affects the bully, because the bullies are taught that because I see this play out all the time. I've talked about it before, is that the bullies are told that people don't have the right to be disrespectful to them in any way. So now on one hand, you have someone who's starting to get hurt feelings because they're being picked on, because they're being told that everybody's supposed to be nice to them, and now when people aren't nice to them, they don't know how to cope with that, instead of just dismissing it and not caring about it, because everybody's telling them that they shouldn't be letting people be mean to them. And then on the flip side of it, you have the bully being told by their parents, you know, nobody has the right to be disrespectful to you, don't you take that. And now you've got somebody being aggressive, and the least little thing that you say or you do, they're going to jump all over you, and they're ready to come to fisticuffs. You see this all the time in schools now. You know, students fighting other students, or young people fighting other young people, oh, because somebody disrespected me, she dissed me, or something like that, and over something as ridiculous as insults flying back and forth. And instead of just ignoring it and walking away, it ends up in these really horrific fist fights and kicking and stomping, and, you know, the violence escalates. But when you hear them talk, because I've seen them on some of these judge shows, they go in there, and some of the suits that are brought to court are teenagers beating other teenagers so badly that they end up in the hospital. And then the parents of the other side are taking the violent side to court, and when it gets to court, you find that it was like mutual combat. They were both kind of arguing, and one just got the worst of the battle. But what amazes me is the righteousness in these. Well, she said this to me, and she doesn't have the right to say that to me, and this kind of stuff. And that's where the violence comes from. And that's another thing where it's unhealthy to teach your children that nobody has the right to be disrespectful to you, because it actually incites that kind of violence.
Well, and of course, emotions, you know, are the most unpredictable thing about us, emotions. What makes you happy might make me cry, and vice versa. What makes you feel righteous might make me feel indignant. You know, emotions, if we ran our lives on our emotions, well, many of us do, but when we do, we end up in a really squirrely place, because you cannot run your life on emotions. You just cannot, because emotions are like the Appalachians. They're up and down and all around, so you just can't do it that way. There has to be, every now and then, there has to be something in there that balances you. And, of course, that's a lifelong effort for all of us. But, like I said, I think that learning to understand yourself, of course, is one of the most important things you can do for yourself, and learning how to exercise, you know, the ability to separate how something makes you feel emotionally and how somebody or something makes you feel, you know, in reality. So all that stuff is up to us, and to teach our kids to learn how to do that. If somebody looks at you, I mean, my mother always used to say, if somebody said something mean to me, you know why? They're jealous of you. And I remember my aunts saying that. I remember lots of grown-ups in my life. If you went home and said, so-and-so hated what I had on today, they made fun of my shoes, well, you know why, honey? Because they're jealous of you. Did your mother ever say that to you?
No.
I mean, that was...
No, the tactic my mom took was that, you know, that she loved, you know, my sister and I very much, that we were her world and all that, and that if other people didn't recognize it, then we should feel sorry for them, because that meant that there was something wrong with them, that if they couldn't see the good in other people, they must be suffering somehow. And so it always kind of instilled a little bit of compassion in me, even at a young age, that if somebody didn't like me, I felt like maybe they were hurting somehow, because why would you just want to be mean to somebody? So I started at a very young age with kind of going there and not taking it personally, thinking there was something wrong with the person, that they were unhappy for some reason. And it kind of kept me from – I never got angry when people did something mean to me. And for that reason, I got angry over injustices. I got angry if somebody hurt somebody. But I never got angry when people tried to be mean to me. And because of that, I never got angry or hurt. I would always react in a way that it would stop. Because I told you that I recognized that there were times people were trying to bully me, but because I didn't respond to it, or I should say I didn't react to it, I just responded. And sometimes I would smile, or I would still be friendly to the person, and then it would go nowhere. They would, like, stop me because they didn't get any reaction out of me. I kept acting like everything was okay, and it would stop. And a couple of the people that tried to bully me ended up becoming my friends within a short amount of time, and then they ended up liking me despite themselves. In fact, one of them even told me that, you know, I didn't like you a couple months ago, but there's something odd about, that's what she said to me. She said, there's something odd about you, and I ended up liking you, you know. But in the beginning, she was picking on me because she didn't like me. She thought I was a phony. And then when she realized that it wasn't a phony act, we ended up becoming friends. But it is interesting. And one of the things when you talk about living on emotions, emotions really can help you once you learn how to use them appropriately, because our emotions is the only thing that really allows us to discern whether or not somebody's telling us the truth. Somebody says something to you and you get a queasy feeling in your gut, that's your emotions. And we really all have this ability to kind of to sense that, but we're taught not to use it. But the emotions you're talking about is when you allow yourself to react instead of respond to situations. And instead of in control, you get carried away with your emotional reaction, and you get very angry or very sad or very hurt, and it makes you shut down. That's where kids, if they can be exposed to, number one, being taught the reality of life, and that sometimes people are going to be mean or nasty to them, and that they need to just kind of roll with it and not react so badly. But things like yoga and martial arts are very beneficial. A lot of teenagers get involved in yoga and martial arts, and both those disciplines teach emotional calmness and teach kids how to be able to, like, not allow themselves to overreact to things. So those are two things. Those are two disciplines, and they're fun, that young people can get involved into that will actually help them grow into a better and more well-adjusted adult.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, when you bring up those kind of things, and of course it is about how you deal. I mean, we all have emotions, and it is about how you deal with them and how you handle your sensitivities as well. You know, something that wouldn't bother somebody else might bother you a lot because you're sensitive about it for whatever reasons. I think that our personal life often gives us specific sensitive issues because of how we're growing up or what the deal is at home and all those kind of things. So sensitivities have a lot to do with how you deal with your emotions as well. But bringing up some of those techniques, such as the yoga and the martial arts and things like that, I am a big advocate of anything that teaches you how to control your, I don't want to use the word control, teaches you how to learn more about your buttons, the buttons that people can push on you and drive you to a different place instead of you being in charge. And when you started talking about that, you know what I got a vision of, Shel?
What?
Do you remember Pam and Kenny got married?
Uh-huh.
And instead of doing the traditional dance, they did Qigong.
Uh-huh. Yeah, they did a synchronized Qigong routine.
Yes. And it was there. You could hear people breathing in the room. because they had our, they were so in sync that it was magnificent.
Mm-hmm.
And
like
the
one
level,
person.
Yeah, it was one of the most beautiful things I've ever witnessed in person. One of the most beautiful things. And I think it's a true assessment of their relation, of their relationship. Don't you think so?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Because they were definitely in concert with each other. Their moves were completely synchronized. They looked like a mirror image of each other. And
mm-hmm.
for those who don't know what Tai Chi is or Qigong is, it's very long. You're moving very slowly. You're extending your arm, extending a leg. You're moving your body in different positions, but you're holding for several seconds. It's very fluid, slow motion.
Yeah.
You know, and it's really hard to hold the body in these positions, like to hold, like being stepping forward and putting your arm out, but doing it very slowly. And you have to engage every muscle in your body to hold the position as you're moving your arm out. Then you bring the other arm over, then you bring your leg forward. But they do everything so slowly and fluidly that you're basically engaging every muscle in the body to constantly maintain balance so you don't fall over, because sometimes one of your legs is up, sometimes you're extending forward. And people look at it and they don't realize, try it. Try it for like 30 seconds. It's really, really hard to hold your balance and to hold the muscles. Your muscles start quivering. So it doesn't look like it's a real workout, but it actually is. And it creates discipline in the body. You have to focus. You have to concentrate. And what it does is it creates a sense of self-control, of self-awareness, and of emotional and mental peace. So people that practice Qigong or yoga or these types of what would appear to be like passive exercises, they're really not as passive as they look, because it takes a lot of muscle control and strength to be able to do these slow, very drawn-out movements and keep your balance. So I highly recommend any of that, Qigong, yoga, martial arts, any of them, because they really do bring about a sense of calm and self-control. And I don't think control is necessarily a bad word, but if you can be in control of yourself and not allow yourself to overreact to situations, then that means you're always in the driver's seat. If you're the one who's in control and everybody around you is kind of losing their temper or acting badly and you're staying calm, well, guess what? You're going to be the last one standing, because you're going to be able to deal with the situation better just because of your calmness.
Well, and patience. And God knows there's a lot of us out here that have no patience, no patience
mm-hmm.
whatsoever. Waiting in line at a store makes you angry. Standing and waiting at the DMV makes you angry. If waiting in a doctor's office for sometimes 3 to 4 hours in a specialist office is ridiculous. And it shouldn't be, but patience is important in our daily life, because if we don't have a little bit of patience, it can be a very frustrating day. So,
mm-hmm.
But it's all about, when we talk about kids, it's all about teaching them to expect some of these things and teaching them about all these things. And I do think the exercises that Shelley mentioned are amazing for kids to learn how to have self-control, have some patience, know how to be in charge of what they do. So it's
mm-hmm.
awesome. We should have Kenny and Pam on the show one time, because I think people would just fall in love. And Pam is also a very amazing belly dancer. So she's a therapist. And Ken is a raw food chef. And they are the perfect match, and yours truly married them at Hippocrates. It was one of the most beautiful weddings that I've ever done. So let's move on to Wednesday, because that's going to be a pretty big topic, and we're already down to 20 minutes. So Wednesday we had Shell and Monica and myself, and we talked about brain function, and we talked about what we can do, how we can support our brain and enhance its value to us. What kind of foods, what kind of what kind of things help with ADHD, what kind of things help with Alzheimer's, what kind of things help with all the different things that we know are out there today in full force. I think a few months ago we did a show on Alzheimer's, and I read some of the statistics about how many people actually suffer from Alzheimer's as early as in their 50s. And let's face it, with today's longevity, 50 could be the halfway mark. So you don't want to spend the rest of your life like that. And I know a lot of people out there that are. And the only good thing about that is they don't know that they are. So if there's an upside to it, that would be it. But all their loved ones certainly know. And some of the things that we talked about is the Teflon and the aluminum and all the other things that we know. Many studies have proven in recent years that all of these things have something to do with it. So right. We also talked about our thought process. And like with ADHD, to be able to keep a continuum of thought is one of the problems for somebody suffering from attention deficit disorder. And it means they can't stay locked on one issue and see it through to the end. And there are supplements. There's the magnesium. I mean, Monica talked about a lot of things that she has really done a lot of studying on. And again, there's a lot of studies out there, and there's a lot of things all of you can do in regard to finding out more about all of these things. And I think that the big part about it is being aware of the fact that you maybe need that kind of help. So I think that people should listen and pay attention to that, because that can be awful. That can be awful for you, that can be awful for your family, that can be awful for everybody. And, of course, we also talked about all the drugs that got used very early on when they first discovered the fact that a lot of our young people, our preschool, kindergarten, first graders, were being diagnosed like 35 years ago, maybe even as long ago as 40 years ago, with what I would have considered behavioral issues, mm-hmm. and they started diagnosed as, as ADHD, and I don't even remember all the different initials that they use, but they put kids on drugs to
right.
give them stability. And now, and Shelley and I can testify to the fact that at the Institute, many of our 20-something guests at Hippocrates were suffering from prescription
yes.
addiction.
Yeah.
They were put on things when they were as young as 4 and 5 years old.
Right.
So,
right.
And of course, people know that now. Our hindsight is always so much greater than our foresight. So we did a lot of talk about that. I'd like, Shel, will you touch on, because this is really your forte, touch a little bit about some of the things that you and Monica agreed on to reinforce some of our brain functions. You want to go there real quick?
Yeah, I had created a quick list of 9 items. There's a lot more than this, but just to get started with, the first thing would be to drink water and not soda. Soda is so caustic to our body, and it affects our brain function. If people would just simply start drinking water instead of soda, they would notice some mental clarity almost just from that. The other thing is not to ingest things that have aspartame in it and, unnatural sweeteners. Go to stevia and xylitol and sweeteners like that. But especially diet sodas, any soda is bad, but especially diet sodas because of the aspartame affect brain function. The second thing is not to use things that harm the brain, such as antiperspirants, such as sunscreens that have lead in it. Be careful about what you put on your body. So be careful about what you're putting in your body. Put careful about what you're putting on your body. Choose to have a better attitude. That's the third one, because we can actually assist our brain in functioning better by choosing to have better attitudes, by when something happens to you, doing an emotional check. And this is something that can be developed very, very quickly. And the younger you are, the quicker you can develop it. But when you feel yourself becoming depressed or angry as a reaction to a situation, do an emotional check and choose to make yourself feel better. Talk yourself out of it, because depressive attitudes, anger, and depression actually release harmful hormones into the brain that can cause brain fog. The fourth thing is blue-green algae. And the blue-green algae I'm talking about is the blue-green algae that's harvested from the Klamath Lake in Oregon. And there's a couple of different companies that do harvest it out there. And you want to read their website. I think Elise is actually going to talk one day about the company she's aligned with. But blue-green algae from Klamath, Oregon, is one of the highest brain superfoods that exists today. The fifth thing is omega-3 oils, and there are vegetarian versions of omega-3 oils that are quite superior to fish oils, so you want to search out for omega-3 oils. The deficiency of omega-3 oils, I've read some articles recently, are actually attributed to the onset of Alzheimer's, ADHD, things like that. So if you make sure that you have good sources of omega-3 oils in your diet, you can actually correct Alzheimer's in its early stages, because what it does is it heals and prevents brain lesions, and you can actually start allowing someone with ADHD and some of these attention disorders to start having better mental clarity. The sixth thing is essential silica, which is another supplement. It's liquid drops. It also helps to repair brain lesions. Seven is a good B complex, and there are vegetarian forms of B complex that are highly absorbed by the body. The eighth thing I mentioned was chiropractic adjustments. Make sure that you don't have any subluxations in your cervical area, in your neck area, neck and shoulders, because if you've had any slip or fall, if you've had car accidents, if your neck has been injured in any way, if you've got any injured discs or it's just out of place, pinched nerves can cause brain fog, can cause confusion, can cause headaches. People get headaches, they take medication like Tylenol or things like that. These type of over-the-counter medications over time can cause brain fog. So you want to keep your body as natural as possible, make sure you're properly aligned. And then the ninth thing, and again, this is just a quick list just to get people started and have some things to address to initially start getting their brains working better. The ninth thing is to consider doing a candida cleanse, since the vast majority of Americans have candida and don't even know it. And one of the major symptoms of candida, which is the candida albicans bacteria overgrowth in the gut, which suppresses the healthy bacteria we need to digest our food with and to create an immune system. The overgrowth of candida can cause severe brain fog, can cause severe depression. And if you're feeling depressed and you have candida and you start taking pharmaceutical drugs, you are compounding the problem. Those pharmaceutical drugs are actually going to increase the candida overgrowth even more. So you've just now caused an increase in depression or an increase in mental fog. It's much healthier to deal with it through diet and cleansing and kind of freeing the body of the toxins that are creating the mental fog rather than taking a pharmaceutical that should suppress it. And what it does, it just creates more mental fog. So that was my quick list.
Okay, well, and I think all of that stuff, we really did talk about all of the things that Shel just said, and it is pretty simple, really, at the end of the day. It is pretty simple, and there's lots of controversy out there about aspartame. There's lots of controversy out there about sugar. Blue-green algae has been around for a long time. I can remember way back in the 60s, the first time some hippies came out with the fact we should eat seaweed, and all the controversy that went on about that. And of course, it's developed over the years. And I think that it's certainly at a place where it needs to be recognized. And I have, of course, like I said, from the 10 years at the Institute, you see firsthand. Somebody asked me the other day, "What kind of proof do you have that this kind of stuff works?" He said, all the people that I've ever talked to that utilized it and got themselves to, you know, they're anecdotal. And I said, anecdotal? And he goes, yeah. And I said, anecdotal is like a story. Famous anecdotes from famous people were like life stories that were amusing and things like that. That was my my feeling about that word. And I said, honey, I said, if somebody is dying and now they're not, that's not an anecdote. That's
well, actually it is. And I actually talk about, I'm glad you mentioned it, because this is something that I'm actually spending a few pages on in my book, because medical science and the medical and scientific communities have no respect for anecdotal evidence. And like you said, anecdotal means stories. Okay, however, statistics, the medical testing and the medical statistics can be manipulated so much just by changing the criteria of that statistic that you can actually report false positives or false negatives, because they can really make any result they want come out just by changing the criteria of the particular test they were doing or the particular experiment. So I don't trust medical statistics. I was actually involved in a medical experiment where I had a bad reaction, and the doctor took me out of the – I didn't find out until 2 years later, but I was actually taken out of the test group because of what the doctor did, and I had a catastrophic reaction to this medication, and he was trying to get the medication legalized. I didn't find out for 2 years later why he had kicked me out of the study. I didn't even realize I was in a study, and it came to me through a third party, and I was appalled. And the reason he didn't want me in the study is because he was trying to get this drug legalized and ended up getting it legalized. But so medical statistics are not trustworthy. Anecdotal evidence is what it is, like you just said. If somebody embarked on a raw food vegan diet and started using blue-green algae, didn't do chemo, didn't do radiation, had stage 4 metastatic cancer, and 4 months later they're cancer-free, well, guess what? That protocol worked. It doesn't mean it's going to work for everybody, but it does mean that it can work because it worked for this person. And this is something that I go into in my book. If you read an autobiographical anecdotal story that somebody implored a particular scenario of dietary changes, thinking better, exercising, and they got themselves healthy, that means it can work for you. And you have to investigate these and make your own choice and be comfortable with your choice. It has to make sense to you. You know, don't just jump on the wagon and try everything that's out there, because some of the stuff is really bizarre. But when you read a lot of evidence, and there are hundreds of thousands of people that have healed themselves from cancer completely naturally, read their stories. And when you read it over and over again, that raw vegetables help, that blue-green algae helps, that wheatgrass tubes help, you start seeing this common thread. Give it a shot. You have nothing to lose. It's certainly not going to make it worse.
I still take offense to the use of the word anecdote, because the actual definition of anecdotal is not necessarily true or reliable, because based on a personal account rather than facts or research. So,
right.
But then, what's a fact? A fact is something that you enact and come out with a result, right?
Isn't exactly.
That a fact? Okay. So to use the word anecdotal when somebody, yes, it's their story. And I mean, there used to be a column in one of the newspapers in upstate New York called Famous Anecdotes. And they were funny stories about famous people. And it didn't mean that they weren't true, though. A story doesn't mean that it's fiction. We have fiction and nonfiction, right? I don't know. I took offense to that, and he got very, he got very defensive, and he said to me, I'm just saying, you know, that it's their stories. That there's no facts. And, of course, we heard this all the time at the Institute. You know, where's the facts that prove that wheatgrass is going to make you feel better? Well, use it and find out. So
right. Well, Hippocrates publishes the Recovery Magazine. At the end of every year, they come out with their recovery issue. I've gotten everyone since since when Hippocrates opened. I have some that were in a little 8-page white and green pamphlet, you know.
Yeah.
And when you read these stories, which is anecdotal evidence, and I agree with you, I find it offensive also. But this is what the medical and scientific communities use to inspire people not to trust the information. And my point is that anecdotal evidence is actually more trustworthy than medical and scientific statistics because it can't be manipulated. It is what it is. If this person
any kind of thing like that is still up for grabs. You know what? We can't talk about this anymore, though, because we've sidestepped Thursday, and I want to say we've only got 2 minutes left, and I real quick want to say Thursday's show generated a lot of controversy about the bath salts man. And today on Facebook, there's a big picture of him and a video, and I talked about this at the beginning of the show. And all of his friends and family said he's like a gentle giant. Everybody loves him. He has friends that he treats like family. He's this wonderful guy. And yet, on this video, you hear him growling. You hear him growling. And after he's been shot 2 times, they have him grayed out because he's unclothed. But even after he's been shot and they're telling him to stay down, he growls again and tries to stand up after being shot twice, and they end up shooting him again. It is horrific. But again, this is all about the bath salts. I encourage everybody out there with young members of their family who might be in a inquisitive time in their life, and young people always think they can handle everything. This isn't going to do that to them, and they almost want to prove it. So once they've put out something like this that has been out there for the whole world to see, please, please, please keep an eye on all the kids. Please understand that you should talk about this and give this particular story a twist to show the reality of this, is this could happen to anybody. It doesn't seem to matter. I like that they said he was a gentle giant and it turned him into this, but there's going to be one kid out there who says, you know, that won't happen to me. I can handle that. That might be fun. So please, let's pay attention to this, and maybe somewhere down the line we can find out why there isn't a true attempt to keep this out of small stores and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's me away. I put in big red letters on my notes. Why is there no mass attempt to stop the sale of this drug? I mean, this is just horrendous. So they also showed the young man that he bit.
Oh, boy.
And
you mean the little 10-year-old boy?
No, I would guess he's like maybe 17 to 21, that age.
Oh, I thought he attacked a real little boy.
No, they did. He did a 10-year-old boy that was with his dad, but he didn't bite him. He bit the boy. And you can see the bite marks. You can see the scratches on his head.
Wow.
And he stabbed him with a box cutter that he had in his pocket from work. And it didn't even faze this man. It was like he didn't even feel that. So it's quite a story, and it's all over the internet, and now it's even on Facebook, so you all have an opportunity to look at it. But take this seriously, and once this comes out on the news, I can promise you that there are going to be teenagers someplace who think that it would be cool to prove to everybody that they could handle doing this, and it might be fun. So keep an eye on your kids. Let's figure out what we can do. I'm doing some more research, and I'm going to call some people and see if there isn't any kind of an attempt now to get this under control. So I want to thank everybody, though, and hope that you'll join us next week. We have some more good things lined up, and I like that we've become so versatile. We started out a bullying show, and we've turned to every issue that's out there, I believe. And if you have an issue that you'd like to share and you'd like to get input from, don't hesitate to call in the show and tell us about it. You can reach us at 347-989-0352, 7 a.m. Monday through Friday. You can talk live or you can contact me on my Facebook page, and let me know that you want something talked about. That's what a lot of people do. But for the time being, everybody go out there and have a great weekend. God bless, and thanks for stopping by. Thanks, Shelley.
Thanks, Renee. Goodbye, everyone. Have a wonderful weekend.
Bye-bye.